Hi everyone, I'm Elisa, and today I'm going to talk a little bit about celestial holography, the things I've been learning over the past 2 months with Sabrina. Okay. So I'm going to start just by talking about holography as a general concept. I'm going to talk a little bit about some Penrose diagrams, talk about the symmetries that we're looking for, the ones we found, dive into how they come from soft theorems, and finally conclude with what the holographic map looks like for celestial holography. So let's begin with holography. It used to be that everyone believed that the degrees of freedom of space lied in these space-filling fields, that there were continuous degrees of freedom everywhere, that the volume, degrees of freedom, you needed to be filled completely. And then we discovered that this didn't work if we wanted to find a theory of quantum gravity. So the next theory was that the degrees of freedom of a volume lie on a lattice, where the distance between points is a Planck length. But about 30 years ago, T. Hooft and Susskind came up with this theory that if we believe Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a black hole, that the entropy is proportional to the area, for any theory that includes gravity, the degrees of freedom must be not only on the boundary of your volume, but also on a discrete lattice on the boundary. So I'm going to talk about that argument a little bit more. It all begins with, you know, Bekenstein-Hawking, the entropy of a black hole is proportional to its area. Now let's suppose, for the sake of contradiction, that for some volume, it is possible that there is more entropy than this entropy S. And since it's not a black hole, there is a smaller mass than the mass of a black hole. Now, let's consider a spherically symmetric shell of matter that's larger. And this shell of matter has just the right amount of mass that will turn this volume into a black hole. So it'll precisely complete this M0 so that now we have mass M and we have a black hole on the left here. So once we bring the spherical shell of matter in, we have a black hole. But now its entropy is at least S0, if not more. So this should raise a major red flag in your minds that we've now defied the second law of thermodynamics, where we started with some entropy greater than S, and yet we ended with S. So this is a major contradiction and means that any amount of volume, any volume anywhere, whether it contains a black hole or not, has at most entropy compared to the area, entropy proportional to the area. Notice that this didn't depend on whether we were in negatively curved space, fat space, positively curved space. This is for any spacetime that includes gravity. So any spacetime including gravity is going to have degrees of freedom living on the boundary. So the most successful application of this is, of course, the ADS-CFT, the negatively curved spacetime in which you have your conformal field theory living on the boundary at r equals infinity all around the cylinder. And you have this duality between data in the bulk related to the boundary. So this is due to Maldacena in 98. By the way, I'm including references at the bottom with their archive numbers in case you want to write them down to learn more about the things I'm talking about. This is where I learned some of the things I'm going to talk about. So ADS-CFT, highly successful. The only problem is, even though it's teaching us a ton about field theory, about gravity, about symmetries, about how the holography should work, our universe is not negatively curved. And our universe is actually thought to have a tiny positive cosmological constant, although but locally it's approximately flat. So ideally, we want to find a way to apply holography to something that describes something closer to our universe, because the proof I showed you about the black hole is not specific to negatively curved space. That should apply to any spacetime. So there must be some theory of flat space holography, and the goal now is to establish and find this theory. So the first thing we do when we're talking about, when we want to discover more about a spacetime, is we can look at its Penrose diagrams, because this is going to collapse like the entire, you know, spacetime into this finite piece of paper. So let's compare ADS Penrose and Minkowski Penrose diagrams. Now, the first thing you'll notice between these two diagrams is that the boundaries are very different. The boundary of ADS is time-like. What that means is that any particle, whether it's whether it's a time-like particle, a null particle, whether it's got mass or not, they're all going to end up at the same infinity. And also that means that massless particles can go up to the boundary and come back in a finite amount of time. So massless particles are going to get reflected off the boundary, we call it a reflective boundary, and they're never going to leak through. This is completely different in Minkowski space because now our boundary actually has, there's two types of boundaries here. We have our null boundaries, which are scry plus and scry minus, we also have our space-like infinity. And here, when we have massless particles, they're actually going to go up to this boundary, and some of them will leak through. will go straight through the boundary, which, so this leaky boundary is a major problem. Additionally, since it's a null boundary, it's degenerate, and it's really hard to formulate a local quantum field theory on this boundary. So this presents a lot of difficulties, and we want to try to find ways around those difficulties to better understand the behavior of this boundary. So let's think about what data looks like in Minkowski spacetime. We have radiation coming in from past null infinity. Some scattering process happens, represented by the S matrix, and then our radiation goes out at scry plus. So really, we want to understand this radiation coming in and going out. And the way we do this is with a metric, but this standard metric is not going to do the job for us. It's not going to be very good at describing the data at these infinities. So we're going to do a coordinate change into retarded and advanced coordinates, as well as stereographic projection. Just quick recap, we're going to project through the south pole, where we're going to draw a line from our first parameterization in terms of theta and phi, and if we draw the line through the south pole, it'll stop at the plane at some coordinate z. That's our new coordinate z. And z bar is the complex conjugate. So if we do go through this process, we rewrite the metric in terms of these new coordinates, we end up with a different way of talking about the boundary. And just I'm going to zoom in on this little plot on the left. So now our new coordinates are, we've replaced time with our coordinate u, which runs from negative infinity to infinity along scry plus, as well as a new our r that goes from center out. And then we have now our new zz bar, which represent like the angle. So here, one coordinate has been restored to the Penrose diagram, but each circle that's parametrized by z and z bar is actually a sphere. And these are precisely what we're going to call the celestial spheres in a bit, which are these spheres at null infinity parametrized by z and z bar. So now we have the appropriate language to describe this boundary, and we're well on our way to start talking about what the symmetries look like. So let's start talking about symmetries. In particular, symmetries really matter because this was like the foundation for developing ABS CFT. Madalena was looking at the different symmetries of ABS, of the CFT, and comparing them, and that is how the theory came about. So that would be the first step for developing flat space holography. Of course, we all know the Lorentz group boosts and rotations, and we know that it is, some of us may know, it's doubly covered by SL2C, where SL2C is the 2x2 matrices of complex elements with determinant 1. We may think about this basic fact and think about what else SL2C corresponds to. So if we're thinking about SL2C, we might start thinking about conformal transformations on a two-sphere. So these conformal transformations are going to go from one point on the two-sphere to another, then parametrized by the angles. And if you go through the proof in Oblak, you can eventually see that these AB, we have our complex values A, B, C, and D, with, if we put them in a matrix, again, determinant 1. So we again find this group SL2C popping up, where before it was popping up with 4D Minkowski transformations in Minkowski space, but now it's popping up with transformations on the two-sphere. This is the first hint that there might be some relation between the symmetries of 4D Minkowski space and the two-sphere. But there's many more Minkowski symmetries, and we want to find all of them, ideally, because we want to exactly describe the structure of the space. We want to not only find the relation between in-states and out-states, but we also want to find the symmetries relating different in-states to each other, relating different out-states to each other, et cetera. So there's one symmetry we've known about for 60 years, ever since BMS, and that one is supertranslations. Supertranslations are defined as angle-dependent translations on cross-sections at scry plus in the u direction. What that means is if you have your celestial sphere on the blue circle, each point is translated up by some amount depending on where it is on the sphere. What that looks like is something like this. We have some detectors spread out around the two-sphere. You act a supertranslation. After some time, the points are going to be moved by some amount depending on where they are on the two-sphere. So this is a preview with a lot of new terminology that I'm about to get into, but just to motivate a bit what I'm going to talk about in a second. We have supertranslations. We've known about them for a really long time. It was shown pretty recently that there is an equivalence. There's a relation between supertranslations and what we call the soft graviton theorem. I'll explain this in 1 minute. And this correspondence allowed us to then look for the subleading soft graviton theorem, which, since we knew there was an equivalence between asymptotic symmetries and soft theorems, led to us finding superrotations, which are like the foundational building block for the development of celestial holography. So this is our preview. I'm going to explain each of these in turn. But just once we have all of that, we've actually established pretty much our whole asymptotic symmetry group, up to some debate, where our local symmetries, supertranslations and superrotations, when we take their global limits, correspond precisely to what we'd expect of the Poincaré translations and the Lorentz rotations and boosts. So the global limit is what we expect, and then these are the local transformations that they correspond to. Okay, so let's take a step back and talk about soft theorems and how they play into this story. Just to start with the infrared triangle, I'm going to present it at the end too, after I've explained all of the vertices, but we've been talking about asymptotic symmetries so far. I'm going to now explain how these lead to conservation laws that are in the form of word identities, and those lead to soft theorems. And then I'm going to present how these are both corresponding to the physical observable, which is called the memory effect. So we have these highly mathematical theories that are going to correspond to something that's actually detectable. So the story begins with actually the Leonard-Richard potential, which is just of a moving electric charge. And when you look at this moving electric charge, as it approaches space like infinity at I0, from below it and from above it, there's a mismatch. There's a discontinuity. They're not the same. It causes major problems. So Andy Strominger, it's outlined in his lecture notes, he established that the way around this discontinuity is to set this antipodal matching condition, where since the field is proportional to 1 over r squared, if you multiply the field by r squared, there's no longer any r dependence. And so we set it equal below and above this point. And so those are called antipodal matching conditions. And it turns out you can generalize this to any angle-dependent function. So any function that approaches I0 from below and from above must be antipodally matched. It must be the same at these two points. What that looks like is this top line here. So any function below and above this infinity must be the same. And that's going to lead to an infinitude of conserved charges, where these conserved charges look precisely like take this form, and below is the general form of the Ward identity. All this is saying is that for any function that's antipodally matched, that's matched above and below this space-like infinity, we have another conserved charge related to radiation conservation. Now let's look at these conserved charges more precisely. So we can use Stokes' theorem to write the conserved charge, which is evaluated at the boundary of Scribe Plus, to write it as a volume integral over all of Scribe Plus. And when we do that, we get two terms. We get the soft photon term and the matter term, where we're only talking about massless particles, so we can ignore what's happening at Scribe Plus. Now, this soft photon term, or both of these terms are going to, since we're talking about light-like particles, these are the ones that are actually radiating out that are being leaked from this boundary. So we want to understand them better, understand how they play into our idea of the S matrix, into our interactions, into our amplitudes. But before we do that, let's just make this very clear. A soft particle, all we're talking about, is a particle whose energy is much less than the energy of the scattering process. And since its energy is much less than the energy of the scattering process, we can take it to zero. So here we take omega to zero. So every time we say soft particle, soft photon, that's all we mean. Now, another age-old topic has been soft theorems. So a really good reference is just Weinberg's quantum field theory. And soft theorems tell us that if we start with some scattering process and we add an external leg of a photon, it's proportional to the same scattering process without the photon. And the way they're related is by these terms in the middle that have, and these are related as we take the energy to zero. And so here we have our leading term, a subleading term, and extra terms that are even smaller. So this might ring a bell that earlier in the presentation I was talking about leading and subleading terms. And the way these come into play is that when we're relating supertranslations and superrotations. So supertranslations correspond to this first term relating the amplitude with a photon to without a photon. And then we can then find the subleading term, which gives us superrotations. Okay, so that's the picture on like superrotations, on asymptotic symmetries and soft theorems. Now, this is all, it's great math. It talks about symmetries. We may wonder, like, how can we detect these in experiments, for example? And so this leads to the third corner of the triangle. So if we were to, so the gravitational memory effect is one type of memory effect. There are several. And the memory effect is a physical observable that allows us to detect, to observe what the soft theorems would look like, what these asymptotic symmetries would look like. So for example, here with the gravitational memory effect, we would place two detectors near infinity. And if we send a wave of radiation past these detectors, this, let's say it's a gravitational wave, it'll like expand and contract the space. But after the space is contracted again, the detectors are going to be like, there's going to be another, an extra relative displacement. They're not going to be back where they started by some tiny amount. So gravitational wave passes through, detectors are in a slightly different position. That extra change in their position is what is the memory. That is precisely the memory effect. And it turns out that if you calculate the difference in the displacement there, it actually exactly corresponds to the addition of a soft graviton, where the soft graviton was added to, in the soft theorem, and we found that proportionality. So we get the same exact term for the addition of the soft graviton as we do after gravitational waves pass through two detectors. That's one way we can measure the effects of soft theorems, because otherwise, you know, very soft particles, they have very low energy, extremely hard to detect on their own. So that's one connection. The other connection, this diagram should look a little bit familiar because I presented it as this is what supertranslations do. It just so happens that this is also what a gravitational wave passing through the celestial sphere will do. If you have some gravitational wave starting in the center and you exude it through the celestial sphere, the detectors are going to be moved in such a way that it's exactly the same effect as when a supertranslation acts on them. So we get this another relation between supertranslations and gravitational memory. And of course, this is as time goes by. Okay. So that completes our infrared triangle, which is now presented with examples, where here what I want you to take away is that we've known about supertranslations for a really long time, for 60 years or so. From these, we found that there's an equivalence through a conservation law to the soft graviton. Since this conservation law equivalence exists, we were able to find the subleading soft graviton and find that this subleading soft graviton led us to superrotations. Superrotations were the foundational building block for celestial holography. And if you want to know more about this triangle, it's also in Sabrina's thesis, which is cited there. Now, the way in which this is the foundational building block is that if you remember, superrotations were associated with a subleading soft graviton, and inserting a soft graviton mode is exactly the same thing. It turns out to give you the same math as inserting a 2D stress tensor. So the key statement here is, like as written, that four-dimensional superrotations are going to obey the same algebra as conformal transformations on the celestial sphere. So this is the foundation of how we developed this theory connecting the 4D symmetries to the 2D stress tensors, the 2D theory. Okay, so this brings us back to the holographic map. Now, there's two ways to approach the holographic map that turn out to be approximately the same. So one way is to look at the boundary, which we already said it's very difficult to work with. It's null, it's degenerate, but there is still a way to work directly with this boundary, and that's through Coriolis fluids, and that theory is cited here. It turns out that it's believed that this is equivalent to the same as thinking about it in terms of celestial spheres, where here the blue lines are the celestial spheres connected to the U time direction, the green ones are connected to the V time direction. So we can either think of it as like a codimension one boundary, which is null, or a codimension two boundary, which, at least in my head, the way that the coordinates are connected is using this Mellin transform. So the Mellin transform changes coordinates from energy to delta, where delta is the scaling dimension, also known as conformal dimension. So even though we have two-dimensional celestial spheres, secretly there's a third dimension that is the conformal dimension that's also parametrizing these spheres. So although it seems to be a two-dimensional theory, it does have this third component to it. And that's the theory that I've been learning a lot about, that I've been reading a lot about. And the questions that I've been asking that I find very exciting in this field after, you know, giving the whole roundabout way that I've really been like adventuring through it, I guess, is that I've become very curious about how we would reconstruct the bulk starting from the boundary. So to me, if you have a theory of holography, if all the degrees of freedom are on the bulk, there should be a way to reconstruct, to find out what the theory looks like in the book, to find out how the field looks like, for example, how it interacts, how the scattering process happened. And this is being done in ADS-CFT a lot, especially with quantum information methods. And that's where like bulk reconstruction really comes from, using qubits to outline how you would get from one to the other. So the questions that I'm very curious about answering are, how would you do this in celestial holography? Right now, it's not very clear cut how to do this, because it seems like if we use the celestial sphere, that we not only need the degrees of freedom on the red line, but we also need integration constants that go into the bulk. So right now I'm trying to calculate to see if there's a way to instead use the degrees of freedom we know from the blue line and relate them to each other to see if we can avoid going into the bulk in order to figure out the theory inside the bulk. So this is some very exciting work that I've been working out that's been very fun. And I just have like a quick summary slide in case, just like the big points I've hit, all the references in case you want to take a picture to read some of them or write them down. And I finally wanted to acknowledge that Sabrina has been a great help in pointing me towards the right resources. And also, I'm very grateful to my friends who listen to me practice over and over. So, thank you.
Can you explain the difference between like super translation, super rotation, and regular Lorentz transformation on the celestial sphere? Because it's just one point going on the sphere from one point to another, and how it's different from regular Lorentz rotation.
Okay, this is a difficult question. Yes, I can try to outline at least my current understanding of this. So we have our asymptotic. Super translations are different from super rotations in that when you take the global limit of them, the super translations simplify to the Poincaré translations. So that like that's all they are when you take the global limit. Versus the super rotations, when you take the global limit, they simplify to the Lorentz rotations and boosts. So that's how I form an intuitive picture of them. These are local transformations versus these are global. So like these are infinitesimal, they're small little action. And all of these are the symmetries. When we're talking about the asymptotic symmetry group, we're talking about the Minkowski space. So like, these are all symmetries that we're finding in Minkowski. I guess at least the relation for super rotations is in this statement that the four-dimensional super rotations in Minkowski obey some algebra. And it turns out that like it's this, if you relate them to like using the 2D stress tensor, if you relate them to the 2D celestial sphere, it obeys the same algebra. So that's the relation as I understand it. But I know there's a lot more resources on this too, especially in Sabrina's thesis on super rotations. There's a much more detail on how they're related to each other.
So on the side of the
Cartesian
memory. Just trying to understand the physical picture. Blue lines are
here.
So the blue lines are metaphorical, some kind of from.
They're two detectors. These are two detectors starting at past time like infinity, ending at future time like infinity. They're just two detectors placed near the boundary because the effect is stronger near the boundary.
So the blue lines are not scattering things. So
no, they're just two detectors.
Where do we end?
The way I understand it is there's a scattering process. It's like there's always scattering processes happening. And so if there's a scattering process near these detectors, like the soft graviton would be added. Another way to explain this is from the fact that there's that BMS, again, they found that the Minkowski vacuum is infinitely degenerate. And since the vacuum is infinitely degenerate, these gravitational waves or whatever radiation waves are going to move you from one vacuum to another, from one vacuum to another. And adding a soft graviton will do the same thing of moving you from one vacuum to another. So it comes from this infinite. And also super translations will get you from one vacuum to another. So that's why they're all related with respect to this infinite vacuum. Well, so many questions.
Yeah, do you explain a bit more about the motivation for moving from like being in the house in the air and the bathroom and also like a spherical construction?
Yeah. When we're working with the standard Minkowski metric, we have our time coordinate, our radial coordinate, and our spherical coordinate. These are not very precise when you go near the boundary because like you have your time moving and you have your radius moving, and then you have just like a generic sphere. Doing the stereographic projection allows us to more closely. So I guess like, yeah, this is better for comparison. The stereographic projection allows us to have these spheres that exist at null infinity and coordinatize spheres that specifically spheres at null infinity. So that's the key point there, that like we couldn't do that before. I don't know if that helps answer the question. It helps if you do the math of like getting from one metric to the other to understand how they're related. And also that since the null boundary is at both infinite time and infinite radius, it helps to have more finite coordinates, because that way we can move along u, and since u is t minus r, u is the is like is yeah it's easier to work with than like infinite t and infinite r. Yeah.
It was related to what Dawit said.
Okay, so with the detectors, like in theory, you would be able to put them from like past, you know, time like infinity to future time like infinity, right? Just like have them there. But if one were to actually go and attempt to make detectors and try to measure this, what would you do physically? Like, would you just have them there?
So it's actually thought that the next generation after LIGO might be able to detect this effect, because LIGO was not quite sensitive enough to detect a difference between before and after the gravitational waves pass through. But it's possible that the next space-based ones, the space-based gravitational detectors, will be so sensitive that they'll be able to see the difference between before the distance between detectors before gravitational wave and after gravitational wave. So that's a very like big hope in finding this physical observable for the next.
The idea is you don't actually need it going from past time like infinity to future time like infinity. You just have to have them so detect before and after gravitational wave.
Anything with mass is going to start here and end there. This is like everything massive starts at past time like infinity and ends at future time like infinity. So any detector we make is going to start here and end here. Yes, they won't be as close to the scribe plus and minus if they're, you know, near us, but this like our mass like trajectories go from here to up.
But we didn't make the detector like infinitely far in the past, right?
No, this is just the like projected. Like all that matters is like before and after gravitational waves.
Yeah.
Like the d to d plus lambda is what matters here. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there any other result for bulk reconstruction in the flex space?
Is there any result right now? So I've talked to Benny Yoshida a little bit about this. There's some people working on it like at UBC, and even there's some people here that have worked on it. I haven't worked through everything they've done, but it seems to not all be in agreement. So like I think there's different people have different theories on how to do it and how to go about it. There's some major unanswered questions that we're trying to ask still, such as like where are the qubits? What is our equivalent Ryu-Takayanagi formula? How do we define the entanglement entropy between the two? Like all of these are still unanswered questions. So like I think people have different theories on how to go about answering them, but some people are working on it. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Recording stopped.